not want to talk Cubs at all? Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm not saying okay. that. I'm just saying that somebody could be listening to this in 2 weeks and we could have won the World Series or...
right. Or not have gotten to it at all. Yeah.
Yes. It makes for a, makes for an odd listening experience.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about where it's at right now. And yeah,
that's fine. I mean, we can
make it a...
Choose your own adventure?
Yeah. Choose your own adventure book. And we'll say, if the Cubs have won, we have recorded this ending. If they did not, we've recorded this alternate ending.
My daddy wants you to know a lot of the episodes have mostly clean language, but this episode has some words in it that aren't meant for all ages. So, if you have kids like me in your house, you may want to put some headphones on for this one. You've been warned. Done.
Go on.
Zdrastuche, which is... hello in Russian, believe it or not. I'm really expanding my language with this podcast alone. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Daddy Unscripted. I'm glad to have you all here listening. And you may be wondering why the very first word in this was Russian. On all of my episodes, I try to greet you in a different foreign language. And the last episode with Kevin, where I used Irish Gaelic for a reason, I would say if I had to bring a tie-in with the Russian, it would be because Kevin's favorite hockey team is the Detroit Red Wings. And for any of you who know of the Detroit Red Wings, some of their very strong players of recent past have been Russian players. So this Fork in the Road episode with Kevin, who is the band manager for Umphrey's McGee. So during this Fork in the Road, we were originally thinking we were going to talk a fair mix of music and sports, very similar to what took place with Ryan Stasek's Fork in the Road episode, but it pretty much ended up staying a lot on music, and we talked a lot about the band's origin and what his role was and how his role has evolved over time with the band, and we also talked a lot about the band's philosophies and what drives them to do things the way that they do, which is very unique and very fan-oriented and very much driven in a way to bond the band and the fans together in a very intimate, organic way that really has always been one of the things that has kept me so interested in the band, in their model that really isn't a model. You'll also hear me tell Kevin that basically they are all in the Matrix in their own world there. So yeah, I think I threw him off a little bit. Regardless, I'm very excited that I was able to finally coordinate with Kevin to sit down for a few hours and have these two conversations and to be able to present them to all of you. Maybe dig into a few things that nobody ever really is able to touch on with Kevin. I think a lot of things, you know, probably stay very, very band related. So I think it's cool to get these little background on some of these people that we know or even don't know and hear a lot about, you know, in the daddy episodes, what has made this dad into the dad that they are and what are their philosophies and ideas as a father. And then on some of these other episodes, putting a little bit more to who is this person, and with obvious connotations with Ryan and Kevin as to getting a little bit more information on the band in general. So with all of that said, let's get right to the episode with Kevin Browning for this Fork in the Road. We are here again for our Fork in the Road episode with Kevin Browning, who is the manager of Umphrey's McGee. Am I leaving anything out in your title description? I don't want to just make it so, not that that's plain sounding, but you know what I mean?
I'm also the janitor.
Also the janitor. Wow. Which, knowing the band, that you should probably be making more than the manager makes.
No, that's actually, I have to give credit to one of our graphic designer, Kyle Baker. His card says president and janitor, which awesome. I thought was very apropos, an apt description. No, you're not leaving anything out. If you want a little backstory, I can give you that because I've worn a lot of different hats over the years.
Oh yeah. I think that is part of the really cool story of one of the many very cool stories of the band as a whole and your role with them. So yeah, get into that.
Sure. So I first met, Brendan and Ryan, guitar and bass player in the band and two of the original founders at Notre Dame in 1997. I was a freshman at Notre Dame. My brother lived off campus and we were at a house party on Marion Street for you, South Benders out there. And I walked down into the basement and I heard a band playing a cover of Bathtub Gin. And I thought, oh, this is good. This is interesting. I thought this, everybody said this school doesn't have any good music. So that was literally the first week I was up there, and turned out that this was a band, Tashi Station, which was a band that Brendan and Ryan were in prior to Humphreys. The keyboardist in the band, I realized, lived directly across the hall from me in my dorm in Dillon Hall on campus. So I introduced myself and started chatting with him. And then my brother was friends with Brendan and Ryan, and he had introduced me to them. And eventually that band split and they formed Humphreys. And I went to see, after about the first 8 or 10 shows, I said to Brendan, I said, hey, I'm probably always going to be here. I may as well learn to make myself useful. What do you need most? And Brendan looked at me and said, well, we sound like shit. Can you fix that? And I was like, well, I think you'll probably have to fix that, but I can help. I can maybe help with the sound.
Right.
So that was how I got into audio engineering, literally just on a whim of, we need help with this. Can you do that? And I didn't know anything about audio engineering. I was a history and government major at Notre Dame. So certainly not something that was in my background at that point. Mm-hmm. But I just started reading a few books and asking a lot of questions, and more than anything, just experimenting. We had very basic gear back then. It was a little 8-channel powered mixer and a handful of microphones and mic stands. It was not a very elaborate setup. The equalizer in my car, I think, had more bands than the equalizer on the PA. So I did that, and I did that, as we grew and evolved, I grew and evolved on the engineering and recording and producing side of things. And in addition to the live mixing engineering, I also started doing studio work. And I was on the road full time with the band for the first 13 years, doing engineering, but also had kind of just filled in a number of other roles, which was really how the organization has operated from day one. Mm-hmm. Not just from myself, but everybody pulled their weight in different ways. And I worked on everything from just helping the touring logistics and travel to spearheading our album releases and a lot of our content, audio, video, videos, sort of everything related to that, facilitated capturing, editing, and producing, those kinds of things. And after 13 years on the road full time, I was kind of burning the candle at both ends. I would come home off the road and basically still work 9 to 5 on whatever project or album that we were working on. I was trying to business develop a number of some of the special events that we do and some of the unique offerings that we put together. I was trying to spend more and more time on that. And it just got to the point where it was too much. And I felt like I was more valuable to the whole organization off the road in a management capacity than I was. It was easier to for somebody to take my role on the road than it was to try to hire somebody to do all the other things that I was doing at home. So in 2011, I got off the road full time. We hired Chris Mitchell to do front of house engineering. He took my place on the road. And then Manny Sanchez and Greg Majors, who were already doing a lot of the studio stuff with me, took the engineering side of that on full time. And I focused more on the sort of bigger picture about the label side of things, distribution, marketing, everything that goes into actually releasing the record, putting it in fans' hands. So, yeah, in 2014, we started our own record label. So I run that for us as well. And, you know, my partner on the management side, Vince Iwinski, another Notre Dame grad, he's been around since day one as well. And he's still very much steering the ship with me, no doubt. It's just when he was doing that, he was managing all those years that I was on the road. Mm-hmm. And he was actually tour managing in the early years. That was kind of one and the same. And eventually it got, where it made sense for him to get off the road, and we hired a real tour manager to just do that piece of it. And then it was sort of the same thing. I got off to manage with him and hired Chris to take my spot. So over, that's kind of the broad strokes. It's sort of whatever needed to be done, is what I did for a bunch of years, and still today in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Or if we don't, if something needs to be done and we don't know how to do it, we figure out who the right partner is to do it, or we go find the right person to bring in-house and do it.
So when you were starting out in school and with your government and history majors or whatever, what had you been aiming at with those in mind?
It certainly wasn't managing a rock band. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
I figured it'd be one of two things. I thought that I would, my initial plan was to try to stretch college to the 5-year plan. My brother did that, executed it very well, spent a year in Spain. So I figured maybe I'd do that at a minimum. And then I figured I'd take a year off and, kind of go do that 1 year, that mythic year that, you can go kind of without responsibility, but go travel the world. And then I figure I'd go to grad school or law school. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to be a lawyer, but I felt like I could stay in academia and, go back to school. I liked school. I liked learning a lot, and it just seemed fun to me. And then I figured I would end up, that was sort of as far as I had gotten in terms of, what I might specifically do with either one of those. Mm-hmm. Instead, after graduating from Notre Dame, moved to Chicago, where the rest of the guys already had moved the previous year. And we kind of figure we'd give it a year or two, give the band a really, all of our effort for a year or two. We'd have some fun. It wouldn't work. And then we'd all go get real jobs. Mm-hmm. And here we are almost 19 years later.
That's crazy. So did you then, as the band is kind of starting to form and all of its different tentacles, I really paused to say that word correctly. I will add.
Hate to Freudian slip the old tentacles. Yeah.
Did you change into a full audio engineer hat at that point? Like, did your majors change and you kind of changed direction with your schooling as well?
No, not at all. I kept studying history and government. Notre Dame really didn't have, they have a great engineering program, but they don't have a real audio engineering program. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I felt like I was learning more. I would talk to some of the kids that were sort of freelancing as mixers, what I was doing, that were at Notre Dame when I was learning. And I felt like I was getting a way more valuable education, night in, night out in these bars and clubs, literally just by seeing new gear, experimenting, trying new things, asking people that had been doing it a long time. I felt like I was learning way more in a practical application than I was in school. I you know, there's a few ways to go about it. I kind of learned all the nuts and bolts of it. Just the practical side of, okay, the show starts at 8 o'clock. How do I make the kick drum sound good? How do I make everything sound good? I had no formal training in terms of the science and math that were happening behind it. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to figure out how to make the thing sound good. And once I got to a point where I was comfortable that I knew how to set everything up and make it work and put together a good mix and capture a quality recording, then it's only when I started going back to try to teach myself, okay, how does that really work? What's the sine wave doing there? How is a compressor actually affecting the signal? So I learned completely practically first, and then kind of the opposite. Cause if you go to school, you don't touch a console out of the gates. You just learn all the science and the fundamentals behind how things work before you learn, or, you know, why they work and how sound travels. You learn all that stuff before you actually learn, you know, how an aux send really works. So
right.
It's kind of a backwards way. At least, you know, in a traditional model, but this is the music business, so I'm not much for traditional models.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we are looking at that, just a quick little fun glimpse, since you said that you guys were all kind of thinking that it would maybe be 1 to 2 years or whatever of really giving it your all and then going into your side jobs, what do you think, or what do you know based upon what everybody was doing schooling wise and whatever, what would everybody in the band be doing today?
Well, I think that Brendan would be teaching English, mm-hmm. or while giving guitar lessons on the side. I'm naturally, you know, speculating here.
Right, right. This is all speculation.
Let's see. Stasic with a finance and Japanese minor, would probably be the GM of the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yeah, perfect. On the Japanese side, especially, like, their Japanese market would be huge.
Yes, they would crush in Kyoto. Let's see. I think Chris Myers would probably be he'd probably be teaching at a very prestigious music academia, while playing, weddings and bar mitzvahs on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Just for fun. Cause Chris loves playing bar mitzvahs. Let me tell you, Jake, there's absolutely nothing that Jake would ever be doing in this world than creating music. Mm-hmm. The guy is, a voracious creator, and his brain works at the guy writes sometimes multiple songs per day. Mm-hmm. I can never see him doing anything besides what he's doing, in some capacity. Let's see. Andy, I hope Andy would own a screaming barbecue restaurant. I think that's as much about what I would want Andy to do.
Yeah.
I could see, Andy getting up at like 4 a.m. to get the smoker going. And then about 7 a.m. he'd hand it off to his minions while he went and hit the links, played 18, and then come back.
Yeah.
And Joel, Joel.
Oh, God. Joel would be like, you've seen Legends of the Fall, yes?
Yeah.
Joel would be that section of Tristan's life where he's on the boat and living amongst the indigenous tribes of various islands.
Yeah. The thing is I think that Joel might be doing exactly what he's doing now without playing the music part, just traveling the world. You know, the guy's a jet setter, and I love him for it. Him and his wife get out and travel. He literally just got back from about a 12 country stint in Europe for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So I think he'd still be doing that, just with some other oddity to pay the bills.
Right. Well, he'd probably be like a food or wine critic around the world, maybe even have like some kind of show on the Food Network or on the Travel Network.
I could
to pay the bills.
Yes, he definitely he definitely could have a travel show.
Right, right. Okay, so that was a weird little offshoot, but had to be done. So you are then, I mean, bringing this all into play with our previous episode, you are in your new relationship with Shay. You are learning a completely different tool set for your life, for career, and spending so much time doing it with the guys. What was it like during those college years? I mean, with having to balance everybody's different schedule, whether it was classes or, I mean, I don't know if any of the guys were actually doing jobs during that time as well, but how difficult was all of that, piecing it together with so many different people trying to actually play the gigs that weren't being played right there in your own backyard, basically?
Early on, it didn't feel challenging because it was mostly South Bend gigs or really close. And then it did get logistically a bit more complicated as we started to expand that. I missed a handful of shows at the end of my senior year when the guys were traveling a little further to a few spots. And I felt like I had to finish school, and I did not want to be present for sort of the end of my collegiate career. So I skipped a handful of shows at that time that didn't coincide with my schedule. But it was, you know, when you've got a group of people that are all really committed to the same thing, it was all of our priorities. So while it seems like it was challenging, it ultimately it's what we all wanted to be doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, it didn't prove as tough. I mean, honestly, when I met Shay, I was like, oh, I said, you're absolutely amazing. I'm having so much fun hanging out, but like, I don't think this is a good time to start a relationship. Like I was starting my junior year of college. I had just moved off campus. I was traveling with the band more and more. And I was like, honestly, like I wanted to be selfish. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to be traveling a lot. And I don't want to, you seem way too awesome for me to, string you along. And she basically just ignored me. She was like, okay. And which was, she clearly was the wiser of the two of us at that moment, because I couldn't stop calling her, or there was no chance that I was going to not pursue her, because she's amazing and awesome. And I realized relatively quickly that I would be an absolute idiot to let this one go. But, you know, expanding over the years, it was hard to balance all of those things, to balance a relationship with being gone so much. And those are just things you work through, and you figure out, and you make sure that you really capitalize on all the time that you have together. And in a lot of ways, it taught me a lot about myself, and it taught me a lot about our relationship, and that I realized that if I was gone for 3 weeks, that it was really hard to be away. But when I got home, I was home for two weeks, and we could then spend two full weeks together. And it made me appreciate the quality of the time that we would spend when we were together, in that same 5 week window. If we were waking up next to each other every single day, we might have taken some of that for granted. In fact, I'm certain of it. So it made me, it was challenging, and it put strain on the relationship, but it made us recognize some things that, you know, some of the pluses of it, and some of those things that still stick with me today. And while I don't travel, you know, to every show anymore like I did, I still travel, you know, a decent amount, significantly less than, you know, than the band and our crew. But I still travel a decent amount. And my wife, she works for Google, and she travels a ton as well. So we both still, literally there are times where we will high five at the airport, where she's coming home from a trip. She's been gone for 3 or 4 days. I'm leaving for 3 or 4 days. Like,
yeah.
And that, you know, that, I think some of that early time set us up for success later as we both still do it. And
right.
One thing to kind of note is when I got off the road, that did coincide with us deciding to have our first child. And there's no doubt that that played a role in it for the timing of my decision to get off the road, which wasn't the easiest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of the only one left from the core from the very beginning that could still get off the road. Mm-hmm. and not have one of the, you know, it was just the band at that point that was there from the beginning. And so that, you know, that was a little tough because who doesn't want to be home more? And especially as everybody was starting to settle down with their wives and think about families as well. So I do not take for granted the ability to make that decision and get off the road, which is good for, you know, good for me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely a part of it, but it was only a piece of it in that I really did feel like, while it was the best thing for me, I really felt like it was the best thing for us, as we tried to really take the band and our business to the next level and make sure that we weren't missing opportunities because there wasn't enough muscle at home to kind of get things across the finish line. So mm-hmm. It's kind of a win-win, you know, certainly the way I like to think about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So during that transition from college, when you guys are basically headquartering it in Chicago, was that a full bore move? Did Shay come with you as well? And you guys kind of started everything with your family, well, with the two of you as a family there in Chicago?
Yeah, it did. She was a year younger, so she was at school for another year.
Okay.
And then she moved home for a couple of months, but then came to Chicago after that. So we were together. It was about a 16 or 18 month window that we lived in different places, but then she came to Chicago and we've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. So you, with your people that got things handed off to them, were they also like Bobby, who took over basically tour manager? Yeah.
Yes. He is our current tour manager. We had Don Richards, our esteemed tour guide, as I like to call him. he was the one who took over for Vince, when Vince got off the road. And over the years we picked up, you know, as we grew and needed more positions filled, we filled them with, you know, with people that we had known from just sort of doing it over a period of time. You meet people in different places that have different skill sets. And when you need one, you think, hey, we always like working with this person and this person always did a good job. And then we would slowly sort of add on one by one.
So were they kind of doing it? Were you just meeting them in venues, or were these guys who were doing these things for other bands?
Some of both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of them, in Don's case, he had never tour managed before. He just was, he's like, yeah, I can do this. He's mm-hmm. a very bright guy. Again, like all of us are self-taught at every role, no matter what it is. So like, Bob Stone, our monitor engineer and production manager, he was working at the Canopy Club in Champaign and we used to play there a lot. So, you know, he was at a venue and came over, and then some of our other guys had been working for various other bands and we sort of slowly just filled the needs as they arose.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that idea of a lot of you guys or all of you guys being self-taught in what you're doing kind of is another one of those things that seems to lend a hand into the very homogenous and organic feel that the band still, I don't think, has wavered from in all the years that I've kind of I don't know how you word that correctly, known of, been listening to, been sending bills to you guys for facial reconstruction after meltings.
You'll hear back from our lawyer on that last one.
Great. That's fine. I've trying to build up the groups that I'm going to be hearing from these two episodes alone, apparently. But I mean, you know, the still ongoing, the headphones and snow cones, that makes the fan experience so much different. And, you know, I've talked with people in crowds before, and there are the people who don't want to do that because they feel like they'll be kind of isolating themselves away from the experience and away from the others in the crowd. And there's the other side of the coin that feels like it's doing the exact opposite of that, and that you are kind of creating that more intimate connection with the band and with the music and hearing every little thing or whatever. And that's unique. I mean, I don't know, maybe you do. Is there anybody doing that? I mean, aside from maybe somebody in Switzerland?
No, I don't even know of anybody in Switzerland that's doing it. To my knowledge, there's nobody else that does it with any regularity. You know, there's the silent disco concept.
Right.
But that's a different animal. For those of you who have no idea what the hell headphones and snow cones are, it's basically a way, when you go to an Umphrey's concert, you can rent a set of headphones and a belt pack, it's just like a in-ear monitor pack that the band wears. And it has the soundboard feed being broadcast live through it during the show. So you can actually put on a set of headphones and you get a much clearer, crisp mix of the soundboard. It allows you to kind of connect with the band in a totally different way and take some of the acoustics out of a poor sounding venue, or eliminate the drunk guy over your shoulder who won't stop talking, fill in the blank. And, you know, Tim's point is that, yeah, it's not one of those things that's designed to be. I never thought that it would, you know, replace the PA on a nightly basis and people would only go to shows and get headphones. It's meant to be one of those things that some people really like that ability to connect on a deeper level. And it gives you a window into the nuance that's happening that's can be hard to achieve in a live setting like that. And it's just a different way to experience it. It's not the right way. It's not the wrong way. It's just a different option for people who want to scratch different itches. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that kind of thinking drives a lot of what we do and how I try to, experience things. That, you know, that's something that I thought, well, geez, I'd like to hear, you know, when I go to a show, I'd like to hear in a more pristine and a more clairvoyant way, like, you know, maybe other people would too. So, you know, back to your point about the all of us being self-taught, there's no doubt that the ethos of how we operate has always been very differently because none of us came from a background in this business. So in some ways it's really advantageous because you don't have any roadblocks against you, or you don't have any preconceived ideas about this is how, this is how things happen. This is things, how you have to do things. And so you get to kind of approach it with a fresh palate and say, okay, this is what we want to do. How do we go about doing it? This makes sense. This doesn't make sense. And then over the years, you see how your peers do it and you see how people that you look up to do it. And you take the things that you like and you leave the things that you don't, and you change things and you try some things that don't work. And, but it, we never felt constricted by any set of rules because we didn't know what the rules were.
Right.
And we just did what we thought made sense. And, you know, we followed our gut a lot of times, and we made decisions about what, you know, what we valued and what we thought would be cool experiences. And we figured that if we kept it interesting for ourselves, that fans would find that interesting as well. If things ever got stale, you know, half the things that we do are for us, because if the guys aren't having fun playing up there on stage and recording albums, and we're not having fun interacting with the fans and doing goofy shit and releasing things in odd ways, like if we're not entertained, people aren't going to be entertained. They're going to be able to see right through it. So while Umphrey's can be a lot to digest at face value. There's a really high return on your investment once you make, you know, once you put a little bit into it, you can get a lot out of it. Sometimes the barrier to entry can be a little bit higher than some bands, and that's fine. You know, it's not for it's not for everyone, but if you get invested in it, it's a rabbit hole that can be entertaining for a lifetime. So that's why we do it the way we do it. It's as much to keep ourselves feeling good about the thing and feeling excited about doing it, because we feel like that will attract like-minded people who see the value in that and don't get tired of, you know, sort of the same regurgitated, whether it's music or it's offerings or whatever. That's, you know, yeah. That doesn't actually matter what product you're sort of putting out there. That's just how we think it works.
That's good business. Yeah. Well, and that keeps your guys' interest and creates potentially greater longevity. And you guys are kind of like, I'm assuming you've seen The Matrix.
I've actually never seen The Matrix.
Oh, okay. So there's this scene that is very commonly known, which you may have even seen a snippet of this without having seen it. There's this kid that is in this, I don't know, it's kind of like a doctor's office for people with some kind of special power or whatever. And this kid is holding this spoon and is just looking at it and is bending this normal silverware spoon in all these kind of crazy ways and is teaching, I believe, Keanu Reeves how to do it. And he maybe says, whoa, once or twice during that scene. And the kid basically says, you have to tell yourself there is no spoon. And I think for you guys, that is true. You guys are basically in the music matrix because you aren't really thinking outside of the box. To you guys, there is no box. And so all of your thoughts and processes are a little bit, I mean, you're obviously doing some of the, you know, you're putting out actual albums and you're having shows in actual venues. But for the most part, like a lot of your, like you were saying, you're not going through those normal restrictions and boundaries and having to think through those as well.
There is no spoon.
Yeah. So make sure you look up that scene and congratulate everybody in the Umphrey's world that you guys are all in the Matrix. I don't know how they'll all take that, but
I feel like that's one of those movies that, you know, at some point I'm going to have to cross that off the list sooner than later. I feel like it's still very relevant in the popular vernacular.
Mm-hmm. I won't tell you that you need to see the second and third. They go a little bit downhill, but the first one is still worth seeing.
Gotcha. I didn't know if Keanu was ever going to be able to top Point Break. So,
oh gosh. Do you guys have a lot of other things that are kind of out there that you are currently dabbling in or that are on the horizon? I mean, I'm sure you guys aren't like dead on ideas or anything like that, but are there a bunch of new things that are more visceral, fan interactions that are waiting to take place?
I wouldn't put too fine a point on anything specifically. Always trying to stay up on, you know, both where things are and where things are going in terms of what's next. And, you know, we touched on it very briefly at the end of the last episode, but there's so much noise and there's so many ways for people to connect and to be entertained that it can be increasingly hard to kind of cut through the clutter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always try to keep my eye on ultimately where people are and where the eyeballs are to make sure that you know, you can get to people where they are, but it's harder and harder because people are more and more fragmented and, people segment themselves into groups and people are on this social network, but not that network. And
yeah,
some people love email and some people hate email. And so to try to figure out how to keep up with everybody, because we churn out so much stuff and so many, announces for, hey, you know, there's new shows and this tour and this event and this album and this new single and this new mashup record. It's like to try to put every one of those things on every platform every time is a lot of work. And it, you also, some days I still don't feel like we're hitting everybody.
Right.
So I'm always thinking about ways to try to bring people together and under, you know, is there a better way to bring people under one tent than the silos we all live in now? So that to me, but it's hard because, you know, I appreciate and I respect the fact that some fans like an experience one way and some like it another. And some people don't have any interest in being on Facebook and some people only want to be on Facebook. And it's hard to be all things to all people. And we've never, ever tried to do that from a music standpoint or even a, you know, even the way we run our business. So we're not trying, it's never going to be the lowest common denominator. It's never going to be the most accessible thing. We believe that if you put, you know, you work a little hard to get in, we'll reward the hell out of you.
Right.
Those kinds of things inform my thinking about, you know, where we have such a cool community of music fans and supporters and people that travel to see the band that I like, you know, the best way to keep bringing those people together is the live experience. Yeah. And so it comes back to that a lot because, you know, I constantly want to tinker with things, but at the end of the day, getting a whole bunch of like-minded people who, you know, give them a good reason to come together and to see their friends and to travel across the country and have those, create those memories, that still feels like a really good use of our time. So trying to make sure that, you know, that every show is, as fulfilling and successful as possible is still occupies a lot of the thinking, but you know we throw lots of stuff at the wall and we'll continue to do so until we shuffle off this mortal coil.
Yeah. Speaking of like the show and having that be a good experience for others as well as good for you guys and profitable for the business, quote unquote. How often do you revisit or look at venues and change of venues and areas? I think this comes more from me because I'm Southern California, because, you know, I got to experience the changeover from just House of Blues shows and finally feeling too pinched in that venue to you guys growing out to where you're now at the Wiltern. And I think that's it, right? Like, I don't know. You did San Diego 2 years ago, but you didn't do it this year, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So how, like, is there a, towards the end of the year when you guys, I know you just released the first little grouping of shows for next year, at the end of or at some time in each year, are you saying, okay, so LA, where two of our band members live, what is the demand like for those shows? We're, you know, hitting there in March. Is there another venue that we should be hitting in San Diego or in Orange County? Is there, you know, a demand for more nights in LA or whatever? How often does that take place? Is that constant?
Yeah, that's an ongoing constant conversation, both with the band, with management and with our agent.
Yeah.
There's only so many shows that we're going to play in a year. And there's only so many shows that we'll do, you know, in a particular 6 or 7 week period. And there's only so many shows per week. And there's a ton of markets and you got to sit down and assess the goals and the value of all of these plays. And it's, you know, when you announce any tour, it doesn't matter what it is, go look at the stream of comments and there's always 30% of the people are always complaining about why are you skipping this market this time? And I get that there are so many decisions that go into there's so many factors that go into each one of those decisions about when and where and why and how. And I mean, people wouldn't think, but like we check the, we know every single football game that's being played on every single Saturday in every market, particularly the SEC in the Southeast. Like, you don't ever go up against, you know, you don't ever go play on the Georgia Auburn game. You stay out of this market. And
right.
You know, there's 100 of those decisions about who gets what on what days of the week and what the venue is and what's the venue size and who's the promoter and what kind of deal can you get. And, you know, sometimes there's not a good venue in the right market, or you can't get the venue you want on the day you want, or
yeah.
And all of those things, you know, all of those things influence our decisions. And it's a little bit harder for us to get to the West Coast and to spend, you know, as much time out there as people dwelling in Southern California might so want. And so it's, you know, everything when you play one more show in the Midwest, maybe that's one fewer that you can play in LA, and maybe you do that, you know, one year, and then the next year you tack another 3 or 4 days onto the West Coast tour, and you do 3 or 4 less in the Northeast. And, you know, every play you're thinking about so many different factors. And we, you know, it's part art, it's part science. And despite what fans think, our goal is never to piss you off by not playing. And, you know, some markets are better than others for us, and some markets have more promise to develop. And you just take all those factors into consideration before deciding. And, you know, and then there's the personal side of it. Vince and I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to keep the guys home as much as possible, mm-hmm. and you know, make the quality of life for the touring as good as we can for people with families and for everybody for that matter. So it's a delicate balance. There's a lot of bills that got to get paid, and there's a lot of salaries that got to get paid. So you got to play.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of any business. You gotta balance all those things and come out with a strategy and a plan that you think best suits the most of them, and onward you march.
Yeah. And that was not my angry speech about LA, by the way. I mean, I wouldn't say no to more shows out here, but I was just saying that because I can't really speak on behalf of the people who may be angrily yelling from I don't know where, Milwaukee, Atlanta,
right,
wherever,
right here in lovely Chicago. But they're having a good fall here. We did 2 dates in September and 3 nights of New Year's here in lovely Chicago. So I think most of those voices have quieted for now.
That's
hey,
good.
You know what? At the end of the day, I'm flattered by the fact that people get pissed that we're not playing near them, because to me that means we're doing something right.
Yeah, I was going to say that the fact that there is some of that mumbling and grumbling is a sign of good things. So
it sure beats nobody caring. Oh, yeah. They're not coming here. Oh, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? We'll go see Chicago instead. Have you guys, just because I'm thinking of that, has there ever been any talk, and I don't know how many bands actually do it, of the outlying states like Hawaii and Alaska? Is there any drive there at all?
Hey, if you can find 2,000 of your closest friends to come follow us around Hawaii for a week,
you guys would be very excited to do
all
it.
All over it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it comes down to time and logistics and money, and like you have to develop markets.
Right.
And, you know, we could go to Hawaii and the show may tank, which you can't just, just
go just to go.
Yeah. Well, just because you can sell, 2,500 tickets in LA doesn't mean you can catch a flight to Honolulu and 2,500 people are going to come in Honolulu, which it's fine. And you just have to be realistic about, hey, if we want to make Honolulu a market, that's okay, but we're going to have to go, and we're going to have to go back, and we're going to have to go back a second time. And you can only do that to so many places. I mean, we had the same conversation about overseas, where it's like, oh, we'd really like to do more business in Europe and go back to Japan and Australia. And it's, you can do that, but you got to, you know, the opportunity cost is you're either playing more shows and you're gone more, which isn't really an option for us right now, or you're not playing a week of shows in the States.
Yeah.
You know, so you just have to, you got to decide what's important, you know, what's most important for now and kind of follow that track or else. But Hawaii, Alaska tour, let's book it.
Suck. Yeah. Because I said that, I might just add, I get like the emails and I can't remember where, what I did to make this happen, but I get them from Live Nation for, gosh, maybe Colorado or some Seattle or something, as well as like, these shows are coming to you in LA or whatever. So I might have to try and sign up for Alaska and Hawaii just out of curiosity to see what actual bands make it out there aside from Don Ho's Tiny Bubbles or whatever.
Yeah. Which, I mean, bands, I don't know about Alaska, but Hawaii certainly has some native sons that do, you know, that do well there. I feel like if you grow up gigging in Hawaii, it's like you just gig there for a while. You know, you develop that market. Some bands, some friends of ours, Iration, who we had a support on some shows a while back. Those guys are from Hawaii. And I'm always like, that, it's not a terrible place. You know, we come from South Bend. They come from Hawaii. It's very, very similar.
Yeah, exactly the same mirror images of each other. I'm glad you said that because that was going to be the next question I was going to ask was, what goes into that process behind the scenes for you guys of who you bring on tour with you? Like, how did that connection happen between you guys and Talk this year? Or maybe that started last year and now I see that there's somebody else who's on, I was going to say on the ballot with you guys for the beginning of next year. But how does that process take place behind the scenes?
Vote Quimby. let's see. So that there's a number of different ways that that can happen, depending on what the markets are. You know, ultimately you want to find a good, cool band that is worth some tickets. It depends on, you know, the run of shows, whether it's an individual night or it's a full tour. We, you know, when we were coming up and we felt like a good way to, obviously a good way to get in front of new audiences was to play with other bands that were more established. And we appreciated the support we got from people like, you know, from having people like the Allman Brothers and Dave Matthews, have us open for shows. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, it was a big opportunity for us. And it's also good for them because, you know, they do it in markets where we sell, you know, where we sold a lot of tickets. So kind of on the flip side of that now, where we want to expose people to other good bands, things that they'll like, things that make, you know, can make it a little bit more of an event, on a night out. And also that can help, you know, that have fan bases of their own that can help bring some people out, and it's kind of a win-win all around. But
right,
you know, we look at a number of factors, you know, from the quality of the music to their value at the box office, and sometimes we take bands out because we're like, yeah, this is a great band. People ought to. It's more of just a value add where people ought to experience this, and you know, let's do some shows with these guys so people can, you know, just help get the word out. So
I'm sure that's one of the benefits of having your own label, that you're not having, you know, Warner Brothers tell you this tour, you're going to be touring with Janet Jackson.
Yeah. There's really nothing that we have to do that we don't, decide for ourselves. There's no, we, you know, over the years we made decisions so that we never
have to answer to the man.
Yeah, we never put the control in anybody else's hands because we knew that nobody was ever going to care more about it than we were. Nobody was ever going to be more in tune with it than we were. You know, if it meant that we traded a little bit of, you know, I was going to say the word success, but I don't even define it that way because to me, it's more successful to control your own destiny and be able to make the decisions you want and feel good about putting your head on the pillow at the end of the night than you do about having to compromise the things that you don't want to compromise just because it was a little bit more lucrative. So, you know, we make those decisions based on what we feel good about, not necessarily what you know, is absolutely the most profitable or whatever. So,
right. So I know we're running low on time, so we'll do some, a little bit of more rapid fiery stuff at you. All C's. I won't do multiple choice then, because I can see how that's going to go. So when you were a youth, what was the music that you were hearing in your household?
When I was a
youth,
you know, there was not as much music in my household young, from my parents. It really was more from my brothers, particularly my brother Christian. And I listened to a whole bunch of junk for a while, just like, you know, top 40 stuff.
Right.
And then, the first stuff that I started to really get into as a kid was like Guns N' Roses and hair bands like Poison and some of that stuff. And then, in eighth grade, my best friend Rylan and I went to see Pink Floyd.
And
we literally came home and threw away almost our entire CD collections. And it was like, we don't know what we're supposed to be listening to, but we're certain that it's not this. And we got rid of so much of this, like the top 40 noise, and started listening to a bunch of Pink Floyd. And then my brother was listening to a lot of Dead at that point. So got into the Grateful Dead and a lot of stuff actually from my, my friend's parents, which I, you know, didn't realize at the time, but so much great music like Cat Stevens and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then, then the doors just kind of blew wide open once you get into that world and, you know, start the classic Beatles and Zeppelin and that stuff. And then, I went and saw a bunch of Phish shows and, you know, spent a lot of time doing that. And so kind of ran the gamut. And now I listen to as much, Chopin and Mozart while I'm working as I do anything else.
So how much of your work do you bring home and listen, like how much Umphrey's do you listen to that is not stuff like right now? I assume you're listening to some of the zonky stuff before it's released, or you have been recently, but you know, are you going back and like, I want to listen to this show from earlier this year or whatever?
Yeah, I, when the band's on tour, I tend to listen to try to listen to most shows the day after when I'm sitting at my desk, but I don't actually listen to the full show. I pretty much just go to the improv because I've heard the forms of the songs like a thousand times.
Yeah.
That's on the light side. So unless I'm checking, like, you know, I'll go reference like, you know, Chris will try something different with the recording. And so I'll go listen to that specifically. I can listen about 100 different ways. Sometimes I'm listening to just the balance. Sometimes I'm listening to fidelity, or I'm listening to a, you know, we're screwing around with a new file type and I'm listening to, can I hear the difference between these two encoders? Sometimes I'm listening to just the, you know, the guys will have reworked a section of a song and I'm just listening to it from that angle, or I'm listening to the way that the, you know, how do the harmonies sound, or, and then sometimes I'm, I, you know, when I'm at my desk, I just like, I like to listen to the improv, 'cause that to me is kind of the best, sort of benchmark of how the
show was,
how the show really was.
Yeah.
Because I don't need to hear, you know, the verse and chorus of Second Self. Even though I still enjoy it, I just, you know, I just, I don't always go back. So, I still, you could say I still consume a pretty, pretty rabid amount of it.
Yeah. I should have asked Ryan this too. In the lore of the, in the lore of the Grateful Dead, you have some of those shows like the Hallowed Mescaline show from, I think 77 or 78. And there's another show, a complete like crazed out show, and it's like something that everybody kind of jumps after. Are there any of those shows that, that jump out at you
that I'm going to tell you about?
Not that everybody was on mescaline, but that is like one of these kind of special shows for one reason or another that you know, for me, there's a dead show, 7878, which is very easy to remember, thank God, that I don't think that was a mescaline show, but it was one of those shows where they were on fire. And anybody who even likes the Dead, like, I will make them listen to that show because it's insane and it's totally unique and different. You know,
I mean, and hey, that's what happens at Red Rocks.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know what I'm talking about with that show. Are there any of those that kind of pop out in your head that are Umphrey's shows that are kind of unique and special for whatever reason it may be and doesn't have to be like they were all on shrooms?
Yeah, there's no doubt. And, you know, they're probably, I have different reasons that they are
right
the way they are to me. But like there's a, in 2006 in March, we played the Chicago Theater for the first time, which is a gorgeous venue, in Chicago. And it was sort of a big deal for us. And I was, I was mixing on a console that was hand built by Jim Gamble, who's one of the greatest console designers and certainly one of the most like classic old school analog guys. Actually, I'm pretty sure that the Dead in 78 were mixing on a console built by Jim Gamble.
Oh, really?
I'm certain of it actually. And Jim actually came to the show, that Chicago Theater show. And I felt like it was one of those nights where the band played spectacularly well from first to last note. I was really happy with the mix. There was, you know, this outpouring of like our friends and family there from Chicago. Gamble was there. It was like one of those nights at the end where, it just felt like everything clicked.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of those shows, you know, for me that really stands out. I don't know that you'd find every Umphrey's fan that'd be like, you got to go check out
this March 2006 Chicago show. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, that's one that definitely stands out to me. Honestly, less than the shows, it's more even the moments to me, particularly when I was mixing, because you'd have, you know, day in, day out, it's hard work putting on shows, and people are tired and people are on different schedules and things are going on with people at home, and you've got this whole dynamic between the band and each other and the crew. And there's so many factors that go into it. And those moments when everything is clicking and everything's working and the guys are all just seamlessly locked into each other and you love the way it sounds and the lighting cue is perfect with it. Like those are the moments to me that just, I'm like, this is why we do what we do for this 5 second moment. Even if somebody pulls the fire alarm and the place goes dark right now, like these are the moments that, that sort of recharge the batteries and remind you why it's just an amazing thing to be able to do, you know, to do this for a living and to do it with people that you love. And so for me, you know, the last 18 years are just littered with moments like that here and there from shows all over the place, that those are the things that kind of energize and motivate me to keep plugging away.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sad that we didn't talk sports at all. I was really planning on talking about your, I probably wouldn't be able to talk very much about the Red Wings with you, but I know you're a big Red Wings fan. Are things looking good for you guys this year?
I don't think we're going to be great. I think we're gonna be better than we were last year. But yeah, what I will say is, we're sort of in the beginning middle phase of rebuilding after the team was so full of vets for so long.
Yeah. You know,
and such great players with a little bit of youth sprinkled in to make it work. And we've, you know, a lot of those guys are now gone, and it's a young squad and kind of starting over in a way.
Right.
So that's the, you know, that's the cyclical nature of sports. So you're patient in the leaner years as long as you feel like doing, you know, things are doing right or things are being gone about right. Which would be a perfect natural, segue to my Cubs, which,
yes,
5 years ago, lost 100 games and 5 years later won 103 games. You know, there's a that's been such a fun, I mean, the last 2 years as a Chicago Cubs fan, I have not had more fun watching baseball since I can't even remember when. I used to come home from school as a kid and catch the last three innings of, you know, every afternoon game on WGN while I was sitting at my mom's kitchen counter having my snack. And, you know, those to see what's happening now in Chicago is just, it's just really fun. You know, the Ricketts family has approached ownership entirely the right way, has brought the right people in. What, you know, Epstein's doing, you know, well, as a Red Sox fan.
Oh yeah.
His, you know, his beautiful mix of science and art with big data is really something that's fun to watch. And then, the way that Joe Madden has has the locker room enjoying themselves and focusing on the right stuff and, having fun out there, and, you know, the farm system, producing the kind of kids you want that are focused on the right things. It's just a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah. You guys seem to be on, those are the perfect two team comparisons, because, you seem to be kind of on the brink of what the Red Wings were for so many years of just, I mean, you've got really, like, even in a better place, because when you're talking veterans, like, you're talking David Ross, and there's not much in the way of age that comes close to that. You should really be strong, very, very strong for the next like 3 to 5 years, and unless something tumultuous happens, like, really for the 5 years after that, you should still have a go at it. So congratulations.
I think you're right. And that's why it's fun, because it feels like this is how you do it. It's not a, let's go pick up a bunch of vets in free agency and try to just, you know, try to pull the strings right and win it 1 year. And then the team falls apart. This is a different way of doing it. And it's a much more rewarding way to do it from this band's perspective. So,
yeah, I think the satisfaction of being able to watch it all kind of unfold, as opposed to, you know, the way the Dodgers were trying to do it 2 years ago. I think they've actually got some youth now that they're bringing in from their own system, but the way that they were basically just trying to buy once Magic Johnson came in, and, you know, the trade that, thank God, they did with us to take Gonzalez and two other pieces that aren't even there anymore, and spend way too much money on all of that and other pieces. Like, I think there is something very much to feeling like you are connected to these players, that you, even if you aren't really paying attention to your farm system, you're seeing them come in. Last year was ridiculous. I mean, it's hard to not love the Cubs, but, I'm happy for you guys. I'm sure you've got, unless something happened, I'm not even going to say it. We're a couple of weeks away from the World Series, and I'm just not going to say anything.
Yeah, I'll just put the caveat out that as we tape, we're in the middle of the NLCS with the Dodgers. And by the time you hear this, I'm hoping that you're talking to the Cubs winning their first World Series in 108 years. But if, you know, if for some reason it didn't happen, still love my Cubs.
Yeah. You basically, after this recording, either you and most of the band are celebrating somewhere on the streets with champagne bottles, or you guys are holed up in your basements, to be heard from in a couple of months.
We'll probably be holed up with bottles as well. Just true. Morning.
Yeah. All right. Well, that pretty much does it for us for the Fork in the Road. I will again say thank you very much for taking so much time out of your day, Kevin, and recording with me.
Yep. Nice chatting. I hope you out there listening gleaned some redeemable value and didn't just feel like you wasted an hour and 15 minutes of your life.
Oh, not at all. Absolutely not. And I think this is kind of a cool little background bit of information that people don't normally get to hear about the band, and in both episodes as well about yourself. And I know that a lot of people like to make that connection. And again, it kind of falls into what you guys are very big on doing and do so well, which is having that kind of almost feels like an open door policy with your fans. And that's what has enabled me to connect with you guys for so long, and something that I've always praised you guys for. So I do appreciate it.
Yep, no problem. We like it that way too. It's a lot more fun when people are along for the ride. So
yeah, whatever social media tags you want to allow people to find you or the band at, you can run through your gamut right now.
Sure, you can find me on pretty much all of the Twitter and Instagram are at Sound Caresser, one word. And yeah, and then all things Umphrey's you can find it at Umphrey's McGee on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. You name it, the yet to be invented social platform that'll be super relevant by the time some of you hear this.
Mm-hmm. Periscope, yeah. which you guys briefly dabbled in.
Yeah, Periscope kind of got IAB'd Periscope, and once Facebook Live happened, the reality is that the reach of I go where the people go, and
right. The
reach of Facebook Live versus Periscope is not even close.
Yeah, you're already connected to so many people there, and with the new, regardless of how cool the apps may be or whatever, getting people to also add this other thing that they have to be on, that's kind of the reaction I frequently see is,
yes,
you want me to follow you on what now too?
Yep.
Yeah.
Fatigue is set in. Nice chatting.
Right. Yeah. You too. Talk to you later. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I apologize for the little bit of lag that was taking place during this conversation. Sometimes that happens with the remote recordings using the internet for me to be able to record and not be sitting with somebody. I want to thank you all for listening to this and the other episode. You can find Daddy Unscripted on Twitter, now on Instagram, on Facebook, all under Daddy Unscripted. You can find the original website at www.daddyunscripted.com, where you can see all of the episodes, as well as a little bit of filler in between some of them, i.e. a post that I did for Ryan Stasek's episode, kind of a companion piece, as well as kind of a companion piece to this episode with some photos that I've taken of and with the band over the years, and some of the original blog posts before Daddy Unscripted was even a podcast. So kind of cool to be able to go back and look at that stuff. You can send me an email at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. And again, I didn't even thank Kevin during the episode on recording of his allowing, really it was Kevin and myself coming together to strike the agreement for Umphrey's McGee's music to be able to be on these podcasts. So, Kevin, if you're listening, thank you again for that. And you can find them at umphreys.com. And I'm really stoked to be able to have their music on these podcasts and to be able to have made that happen before the episodes with Ryan and Kevin. It just made sense. So thanks for making that happen and for allowing that partnership to take place. And you guys will be able to go back and listen to any of those recordings, those previous episodes with Kevin, with Ryan, and who knows, maybe we'll have somebody else from the band or the band's family on at some point. But make sure you keep a lookout for the next episodes coming out. Again, I want to thank all of you guys for your feedback and your messages. Some of you have sent me some cool information on guests that you'd like to have on, and I love all of the feedback you guys are giving me. You can keep that coming at daddyunscripted@gmail.com, and I'm really excited for all the reviews and how many of you are subscribing to the podcast on either iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Google Play. It means a lot to me, so keep it coming. I'm loving seeing all of that outpouring of love for the podcast and that you guys are, in fact, getting something out of this. So I appreciate that. So keep your eye out for the next episode, which should be in a week or two on the Daddy Unscripted podcast.